This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will welcome in two guests from different political viewpoints to discuss and debate the top stories in state and national politics this week. And we will welcome your input, too. What happened in the news this week that you would like us to discuss? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Hillary Clinton blasted Donald Trump's foreign policy positions yesterday in a speech, called him dangerous. Donald Trump returned the attack and said that her speech was pathetic. We will talk about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton duking it out. We'll talk about Paul Ryan coming out in endorsing Donald Trump yesterday. We'll talk about state Democrats preparing for their party convention this weekend. And we'll talk about Governor Walker and the Wisconsin idea and much more. What else would you like to talk about? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let me welcome our guests. Very happy to have with us Eugene Kane, former columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And Rick Essenberg is with us, too, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Eugene.
Good morning.
All right. It's great to have you both with us. Let's start with this war of words between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. As I mentioned, Hillary Clinton blasted Donald Trump's foreign policy positions yesterday. Here's a clip from her foreign policy speech.
He is not just unprepared. He is temperamentally unfit to hold an office that requires knowledge, stability, and immense responsibility. This is not someone who should ever have the nuclear codes, because it's not hard to imagine Donald Trump leading us into a war just because somebody got under his very thin skin.
Oh, she let it loose. So, Eugene Kane, do you agree with Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think a lot of people agree with Hillary Clinton about Donald Trump's ability to handle or even understand the kind of foreign affairs that would crop up if he became president. I remember a Republican debate with all Republican candidates where a lot of them made the same accusations about Trump not being able to be to step up and to handle the foreign affairs of the United States. Everybody from Marco Rubio to Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham, they all basically made the same point Hillary just made. So, yeah, I think she's right on with that.
Yeah, we'll get to Donald Trump's response in a moment. But, Rick Essenberg, what did you make of what Hillary Clinton had to say yesterday?
Well, you know, I think, as I said before, as a constitutional conservative, this presidential election is a little bit like an NFC championship game between the Vikings and the Bears. I mean, my team's not playing. I've got those concerns about Donald Trump, although, to be honest, I've got those concerns about Hillary Clinton as well. I mean, this is a woman, you know, this Inspector General's report came out, and it is very, very damning stuff. I mean, the irresponsibility that she exercised in setting up this separate email server is nothing to joke about. And the notion that, you know, we shouldn't be hearing more about her damn emails, as Bernie Sanders said, is simply flat out wrong. I mean, it reflects on her character. It reflects on her qualification to be the president of the United States. I mean, this is shaping up to be a very difficult and very, very awful choice in the fall.
Let's take a listen to how Donald Trump responded to Hillary Clinton's attacks yesterday.
I mean, I watched Hillary today. It was pathetic. It was pathetic. It was so sad to watch. And, you know, she's up there and supposed to be a foreign policy speech. It was a political speech. Had nothing to do with foreign policy. She made a political speech tonight, folks, and it was a pretty pathetic deal.
Well, aside from being pathetic, though, he didn't really talk about what she criticized him for so much. Rick Essenberg?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, that's a typical Trump speech. It's, you know, nanny, nanny, boo-boo. You know, there isn't a great deal of substance there. But nevertheless, it's an interesting dilemma for people where it looks like you have the presumptive nominees of both political parties are candidates that, if you look at the polling, most of the country can't stand, and I think for good reason.
I think he said in that speech, though, and I don't have the exact quote here, something about how Hillary Clinton, over the email issue, ought to be in jail, that she shouldn't be allowed to campaign. Rick Hessenberg, what about that?
Well, I mean, I don't know what he means by that. If he means that the objective facts that are being revealed suggest that Hillary Clinton broke a number of federal laws and could very well be and probably ought to be indicted, you and I, if we did it, probably would have been indicted. He's right about that, but that hasn't happened, and. I don't understand the not allowed to campaign part of it. I don't know what he means by that. But then again, I don't always understand what he means.
Presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump said yesterday that Hillary Clinton should be sent to jail for her use of a private email server while Secretary of State. Folks, honestly, she's guilty as hell, Trump said at a rally in San Jose. Hillary Clinton has to go to jail. Eugene Kane, what do you think of that?
I think that's the typical Hillary Clinton has been under siege for these emails for a long time, and essentially the question that never gets answered is exactly, you know, what damaging secrets were revealed by the use of her establishing a private server in her home. It's clear that she broke some rules. She's admitted that she made a mistake on that. But the hyperbole over this email thing, Bernie Sanders was actually right in that the American public doesn't care as much about these emails as they do about her grasp of foreign policy. And it's ridiculous to say that Hillary Clinton doesn't have a good, not only a better grasp of foreign policy than Donald Trump, but a better grasp on foreign policy than a lot of politicians out there right now. The email server, and even the comparison with previous Secretary of State who used something similar, not exactly, but they certainly did something similar, it shows a lot of people that you don't want to get paranoid to the point to say it's just a witch hunt. She did things wrong, but it's certainly out of proportion to what the actual, not even crime, but what the actual mistake was.
Well, you know, tell that to David Petraeus and Sandy Berger. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter, what she did isn't like what other Secretary of States did. And, I have to tell you, Eugene, I agreed with you for a long time. I thought that there was probably nothing there. But, you know, reading this Inspector General report, I mean, this is really a serious problem. And I used to tell people that there was no way in the world that Hillary Clinton was going to be indicted or get into legal difficulty for this, but I'm not so sure anymore. I think that this is a very, very serious problem, and I don't pretend to know how it's going to play itself out, but I don't think it can simply be, you know, dismissed. The level of indifference and irresponsibility that she displayed here is just staggering.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you'd like to weigh in on the Donald Trump Hillary Clinton exchange of attacks yesterday. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Or if you want to talk about another top story in state or national politics, that's fair game too. There were violence erupted at a Donald Trump event again in California. The protesters clashed with Trump supporters. Is this just a sign of things to come? I mean, what is your reaction to this, Rick Hessenberg?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think in a way, there's part of me that wants to say that this is a really, really ominous development, both Trump and Sanders, I think, because it's interesting to me that it's Trump and Sanders supporters who are often clashing. I mean, it reminds me a little bit, I mean, it's not like that, but it reminds me a little bit about the battles between, you know, the right and the left in Weimar Germany, where you have essentially two very nativist and collectivist movements that are very, very angry, you know, fighting over what initially seems to be very different turf, but I don't think turns out to be so different at the end of the day. And so I worry that Trump represents kind of a rise of this kind of nationalist, nativist, authoritarian party that we see in Europe. But then, you know, I calm down and I realize that I don't think Donald Trump is that substantive. I'm reminded of, you know, and everybody calls him a Nazi. I'm sort of reminded of the line in the Big Lebowski where, you know, Walter Sobchak says, you know, say what you will about National Socialism, dude, at least it was an ethos. I'm not entirely sure there is a Donald Trump ethos, but if there is, it's one that worries me.
Eugene?
Well, the violence is very disturbing, and the only consistent thing I see is that Donald Trump, even more so than Bernie Sanders, whose supporters can also get a little angry at times, although I've never seen it reported that they're especially violent. But Donald Trump feeds into the violence, not necessarily by his supporters, but by people who come to his rallies because they really feel in danger of his supposed policies, and he's the one who's attacking them. And when he shows up in public, they come out to show that they're not going to lay down and take it. I mean, if you're part of a group that Trump has threatened to export or to take your rights away, it gets to be some serious stuff that forces people to make a decision. And I think that's a residue of what Trump is doing on the stump. And he's the only candidate who has actually advocated violence towards people who are against him on the stump when he kind of exhorts his supporters to punch people or to, you know, to silence them if they make noise. I mean, it's certainly being fueled by Trump more than anybody else. So violence is never right, and it's hard. It's difficult to see Americans fighting each other. But you can't act like it's happening in a vacuum. All of this is happening or connected to the presence of Donald Trump on the political scene, and we have to figure that out. Otherwise, if he is elected president, that night we won't have a series of inaugural balls. There'll be inaugural riots going on all night because people will always feel like they have to make a stand against what Donald Trump is talking or stands for.
In other news, Paul Ryan, Congressman Paul Ryan, Speaker Paul Ryan, after you know, several weeks of saying he was not ready to support Donald Trump, has now endorsed Donald Trump and said in the Janesville Gazette that he is going to vote for Donald Trump. Eugene Cain, what do you make of that?
I think I predicted, at least on social media, a long time ago that Paul Ryan would eventually cave and support Donald Trump. Because I think other than the narrative that you hear on national news that Paul Ryan is this soul of the GOP and the only real conscientious and very intelligent member, just the spokesperson for a new type of Republican Party, this proves that he really isn't. I mean, this proves that just like the rest of them, he's willing to bow down and support someone who is totally anathema to what he says he stands for. And it should be disturbing for us in Wisconsin because he's, you know, he's a local guy, so to speak. But even more disturbing to Americans that the GOP, the Speaker of the House, is willing to support this divisive and, in many cases, been proven to be a bigoted, sexist, racist politician. Someone needs to stand up against him, but clearly it's not going to be Paul Ryan.
Are you disappointed, Rick Hessenberg?
No, I mean, I wouldn't say that. Look, I mean, Paul Ryan lives in the real world, and unlike me, he's a Republican office holder, and, you know, he can't, you know, simply bloviate. And he had a difficult choice to make because, you know, there is, as I said before, these aren't good choices. I mean, these are both incredibly flawed candidates, both with respect to their policy positions, with respect to their character and temperament. And I, you know, so I don't blame him for doing what he did. I'm not there yet. I think that there is a view among, you know, some people in the conservative movement that Donald Trump is malleable and that he can be shaped to be something better than what he's so far demonstrated himself to be. I'm not convinced of that.
Good luck with that. Every day that Paul Ryan endorses him, you see what he did with the what he said about the Mexican job, the Mexican judge. And that's no small thing. To even suggest that someone of Mexican descent, who was born and raised in Indiana, by the way, won't be qualified to oversee his case because he's Mexican? Do we really want anybody running for – well, that's a moot point. He is running for president. But, I mean, that's the door Paul Ryan opened. Now, every time Trump puts his foot in his mouth, we need to go to Paul Ryan and say, hey, this is your boy. Do you stand behind this? I can't imagine GOP wants that.
When we come back, we'll talk about Donald Trump's attacks on the media over media questions about where's the money for veterans groups that he promised, and we'll talk about the California primary and the race between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in California and how important that is or isn't, and we'll welcome any other issues you want to talk about. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is The Week in Review, talking today to you, Eugene Kane and Rick Essenberg. I'm Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking to two guests from different political perspectives about the top stories in politics this week. Today we are talking with Rick Essenberg, who is president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, and Eugene Kane, a former columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Well, we just spent the last hour talking about media coverage of the presidential race, based in part on Donald Trump calling the political media in particular sleazy and dishonest because he was being pressed about where the promised donations were to veterans groups. Eugene Kane, what do you make of Donald Trump's assessment of political media?
Well, I mean, he might have a point if, in fact, he didn't court the media so much and was actually a creation of the media and has gotten so many breaks from the media that another candidate, or let's say a more conventional candidate, would have never been able to get, that it makes him seem like a hypocrite. And, I mean, for Donald Trump to call, you know, anybody else, any other profession sleazy, when he's done something like, you know, set up this Trump University that's basically bilking, you know, naive people out of all their money, it gets to be, you know, almost like comical at some point. He might have a point about media, but he has no real credibility as a candidate himself to blame the political media for pointing out all the missteps and all of the inaccurate statements he makes, and even the lies when he tries to talk about raising money for veterans and doesn't really make any move to do it until he gets busted out by the Washington Post and other people. Trump is not the one to be making this case against the media.
Rick Essenberg?
Well, you know, I always like to have at least one point of agreement on these Friday mornings, and I think this might be the one. You know, Trump rails against the media, but he is where he is, not because he spent his own money, as he says he has, because he hasn't really spent that much money. It's because, you know, he's received billions of dollars in earned media because he's good for ratings, and the media has put him out there, and if they hadn't have done that, I don't think he'd be the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. So it lies ill in his mouth for him to say that he's been treated unfairly, and I think it should remind all of us that, you know, we've spent a lot of time in this country talking about, you know, the insidious effects of money in politics and, you know, dark money and people. But what happened here was that the media essentially decided that this guy was good for ratings, and so they poured more money into him than any group of donors ever could. And this is, if you believe that distorts the political process, this activity by the media distorted the political process more than, you know, any dark money group ever has.
Let's move on to the Democratic race in California. A new poll out showing that that race really tightening. Hillary Clinton clinging to a narrow 2-point lead over Bernie Sanders in California ahead of the state's June 7th primary. This is according to results from a new NBC News Wall Street Journal poll. Eugene Kane, does that is Hillary Clinton in trouble in California?
Well, she may be in trouble in California. My sense is that it will be the first state if she loses that she's lost that has a majority minority population. She usually does great when there's a big minority population. So it will be surprising if she gets upset in California because of those demographics. But as someone who's been following this, I'm still sort of amazed that people think she'd be in trouble because, I mean, if it's as close as people are predicting, even if she loses, she still wins because she basically will, you know, get a lot of delegates and increase her lead over Bernie Sanders, and she's still on a mathematical path to the nomination. I mean, buying into this idea that if she loses California, she's really in trouble, it dismisses all of the previous history, including, I believe, in 2008 when Obama lost a lot of the last primaries but still ended up earning the nomination against Hillary Clinton. So, no, I don't think she'd necessarily be in trouble. I think the term is limping to the nomination. She would be damaged that way and that she perceived as not finishing off real strong. But, again, once the general starts, it's a whole other game.
Yeah. Why do you think Eugene Bernie Sanders is he says he wants to win the nomination. Do you think there's even a outside chance that could happen?
From what I'm saying and what I'm learning about the political process, because of the superdelegates on Hillary's side, there's really no way for him to win. And he's holding on to the strategy of flipping the superdelegates, which has been recently pointed out that they're all pretty much staunch Democrats and the kind of people who Bernie has been bashing this entire campaign. So I have no sense that he'd be able to flip enough superdelegates to win. So I'm one of those people who thinks he doesn't have a chance, but Lord knows I don't want to put that out and start getting, you know, have the Bernie guys start, you know, gathering up against me. But to answer your question, I think he's now sort of caught up in his own ego more than anything else, and that's why he's continuing. But he's the voice of people, so as long as he's serving as the voice of a lot of people, he should do what he wants to do and continue as long as he can.
Yeah, so what's your assessment, Rick Hessenberg, of the Democratic race in California?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think she's in danger of not having enough delegates to get the nomination. And there is this phenomenon that seems to happen in, presidential primaries where, when the race is really on the line, the voters go one way, and then are in the later primaries are sort of more willing to cast protest votes, and that may be part of what's happening here. The difficulty, I think, for her, if there is one, is that she is going to go limping into the nomination. It's going to underscore the belief that she isn't a very good candidate. And if for some reason her legal difficulties flare up, let's say that, I don't know if there can be an indictment, but somebody resigns in protest because there isn't an indictment or some particularly damning material gets leaked or emphasized, it makes it easier for party insiders to at some point, and I don't think this is going to happen, but I don't think it can be ruled out. I mean, I think there's, you know, probably a non-trivial possibility of it that people will begin to put pressure on her to step aside.
Let's take some calls. We have Katie in Janesville with us. Hi, Katie.
Hi, good morning. This is a beautiful segue right into what I wanted to ask. Listening to WPR over the last few weeks and months, nobody likes Trump. Nobody likes Hillary. They're kind of lukewarm about Bernie Sanders. At what point is it a viable solution to really get a write-in campaign? Now, this is assuming that Bernie Sanders does not get the nomination, but do a write-in campaign instead of people writing in Mickey Mouse or, you know, Barbie or something like that on a presidential ticket, actually get a concerted effort behind somebody for a write-in campaign so that we have a third choice.
Yeah. Do you see, thanks very much, Katie. Do you see Eugene Kane, a write-in campaign possibly happening, or maybe even Bernie Sanders saying, well, I know I didn't think I was going to run as an independent, but maybe I will. Do you see anything like that happening?
Well, my understanding is that deadlines for people to actually get on the ballot in all the states they need to get on the ballot has either passed or is really only days away for most of these folks. So I just don't see that as being that feasible. I know the San Diego newspaper basically encouraged people to write in Ronald Reagan this week, which seemed kind of novel. But again, most write-in candidates at this point would just seem kind of frivolous to me. Bernie Sanders going third party, he's always said he's not going to do that, so that would be a surprise.
Yeah, and Rick Essenberg, do you see anything happening like that?
Well, writing in the name of a dead candidate seems novel to you, Eugene, only because you don't live in Chicago. There's no opportunity for a third-party candidate. I don't think there's any opportunity for a write-in campaign. I think the choices we have are the choices we have.
Do you see, Eugene, Bernie Sanders supporters who are passionate Bernie Sanders supporters saying at some point, if, again, he does not win the nomination, well, you know what, we're going to vote for Hillary Clinton because we don't want Donald Trump in the White House?
Well, that's the way it usually works. I mean, even after a real hard-fought primary battle between people of one party and it gets split, by the time it's time to choose a side, even the ones who supported the opponent come around. Now, the Bernie or bust factor is, you know, I've seen various reports that it's either as high as 20% or as low as, you know, 10 or 7%. In a close election, that still could damage, you know, Hillary Clinton if she's the nominee. So I do see the majority of Bernie supporters going to support Hillary, because if you believe their ideology and what they're talking about, there's no way they would support Donald Trump. And if you concede that people who vote do care about this country, they wouldn't stay home. So
yeah. And do you see, Rick Essenberg, people point to polls showing Bernie Sanders would have an easier time defeating Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton would. Do you see a matchup between Trump and Clinton as advantage Trump?
Well, you know, the thing, and everybody says, and I understand why they say it, that Sanders voters would never vote for Donald Trump. But then you find people come across Sanders voters who say that they would vote for Donald Trump. And I think that the reason is that both of them are making what is essentially a populist and, I think, somewhat nativist. I mean, it's there with Bernie, too, in his positions on trade and globalization. A populist and essentially collectivist appeal. And I'm not so sure that the voters are going to line up the way they have traditionally lined up in the past, and that makes this thing hard to call. It's also not clear to me that modeling turnout, which is always difficult, isn't going to be a much, much bigger challenge this election cycle, because you have the two most unpopular nominees that we have ever had, in the history of American presidential politics. And that may result in a lot of people staying home. And when a lot of people stay home, this election doesn't look so much like it did in 2012 and 2008, and it becomes very, very difficult to get a sense of where the electorate that will actually come to the polls is, and very, very hard to predict the outcome.
Yeah. Do you, Eugene Kane, there also have been some stories in the news this week about whether or not Hillary Clinton might pick Elizabeth Warren as her running mate to woo those Bernie Sanders supporters to her side. What do you see happening there?
Well, I mean, I don't have any information, but my sense is that Hillary and Elizabeth Warren are not real good friends. I've read that, and, you know, they don't seem, that doesn't prohibit them from getting together on a ticket. I personally think it would be one of the more exciting things that could come out of this race to have two women running on the same ticket for president and vice president. So I would see it as a winning strategy. But again, because Hillary is the kind of person who I don't think warms up the folks all necessarily all that well. I'm not sure what the personal connection would be there. But that would be exciting. That would be a jolt of lightning, I think, for the Democratic Party.
You have a comment on that, Rick?
Yeah, it might help her to appeal to Sanders voters. Not sure it's going to help her in the general election. I think that Warren is a very target-rich environment. I'm not sure that their lack of a personal relationship will have much to do with it, but my guess is that she may go in another direction and try to pick a candidate that that she thinks will goose turnout more. Maybe that would be somebody who would have maybe a greater appeal to in minority communities than somebody whose appeal is largely to suburban liberals like Warren.
This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Eugene Cain, former columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Rick Essenberg, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. We'll talk about other top stories in state and national politics when we return, and we will welcome your input. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I think we've done all we can do with the presidential race. We're going to move on to some other issues now. This is the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Eugene Cain and Rick Essenberg about the top stories in state and national politics, and welcoming your input, the issues that you would like us to discuss, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Before we get back to some politics and state politics, another not-so-political topic made headlines this week and pretty much dominated the news for the first part of the week, at least, the killing of Harambe, the gorilla at the Cincinnati Zoo, after a four-year-old boy got into the exhibit. The gorilla was tossing him around, treating him roughly. Eventually, the zoo officials shot and killed the gorilla. Eugene, you noted on your Facebook page that there's more coverage on this particular situation in Cincinnati than there was at the city of Chicago, where I think you mentioned that there's some close to 70 shootings in Chicago over the Memorial Day weekend. Talk some about that.
Yeah, that was basically, my take on after days and days of the Harambe story. It really occurred to me from just searching the internet that there weren't many stories about what was a record of violent weekend in Chicago. And it made me just wonder, when you look at the numbers, why was that sort of like not covered at all? And then I realized, well, of course, because everybody was doing the story about the gorilla at the zoo. So I can't really be accusing the media about this, because as someone who's part of the media, I have to admit, I came late to realizing the significance of that, too. I posted some things on Harambe the day it happened. I wasn't really all that focused on the violence in Chicago. I think that's what happens to us these days. It becomes so incredibly violent and really just kind of hopeless to figure out, well, what can you do other than note that it happened? And it takes a lot more. I think the thing about the media could do is just do more investigating as to the root causes of some of this. I've went and looked at some of the Chicago papers who have identified certain things in terms of the gang activity in some areas of Chicago, the laws that are letting some violent criminals out early, the recruitment of young people into these gangs that might, explain. And then, of course, there's the preponderance of all these illegal guns that once were legal guns but fell into the wrong hands. So it's just such a difficult issue to comment on. And the research, it takes someone willing to do the research to explain it, because you have to be able to explain why 70 people get shot in America over a weekend and nobody reacts in a way that suggests that this is a crisis or an emergency.
Yeah, and while Harambe might have been a story to cover, Rick Essenberg, any thoughts as to why we're not even, we're hardly blinking an eye at such urban violence in Chicago?
Well, I mean, it's sad. I mean, I think we need a greater sense of urgency about Chicago and cities like Chicago. You know, the Harambe story may be attractive to the media because it's a little bit unusual, and urban violence, sadly, is not. It may have caught fire on the internet because, you know, it lent itself to sort of like an easy form of self-righteousness where people could, the internet mob could go online and sort of prove their own virtue by, you know, denouncing this mother, denouncing the, you know, the people at the zoo who had to make a very, very difficult decision. You know, the problems of urban violence are very, very complicated. They seem to be intractable. And sometimes I think the way that we deal with that is by deciding that we're going to ignore them. But, you know, for someone like me, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, government is supposed to improve your diet. Government is supposed to somehow, you know, regulate the economy and find you a job. And I don't think government does those things very well. But the one thing the government ought to do is, and I think every citizen has a right to demand, that they also ought to be able to live in their neighborhood, anywhere, and not have to worry about getting shot when they step outside their house. And the fact that we have a situation in some parts of the United States where that's not true, where people don't have that security, and they're not able to live their lives and improve their conditions because of, you know, the danger that they face every day, that's appalling and intolerable, and we need to have a greater sense of urgency about it.
Let's go to Greg in Milwaukee. Hi, Greg.
Good morning. How are you all? I have an issue with Mr. Kane. Mr. Kane reports that there seems to be more news about the silverback that was terminated because of an accident, a three-year-old, and perhaps we can all argue that the mother should have been watching the child more, but it happens, but it's so rare. My thing is, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is not devoted to the Chicago news and the killings there, nor are they supposed to report all the killings in L.A., perhaps in Texas and everything else. I only offer that perhaps he should have answers on how to solve the problem of the shootings, the young people shooting each other because they feel that they're stronger than the other or one-upmanship on the other or something. I have no idea, but perhaps he would like to pursue that.
Well, all right, Greg, so you kind of, Eugene, you want to follow up on that?
Well, I mean, if I had the solutions, I'd be a lot more valuable than I am to this community. So I do agree with him that, you know, essentially it is a problem that needs to be looked at more than people do.
Yeah. Let's talk about some other issues in the news. Actually, I wanted to just a quick follow-up on, he just mentioned the mother, maybe the mother should have been watching the child and maybe she should be charged. I wanted to ask you, Rick Essenberg, I know you're not that type of lawyer, but a lot of people were saying that she should be charged. She's not going to be charged, but could she be charged?
You know, one of the things that I really try not to do is, you know, so often, you know, we're willing to, you know, to leap to the conclusion that somebody has committed a criminal act without doing the necessary research and investigation to know whether or not that what we're saying is true or not. We do that every time there's a police shooting, and I think we're doing it here. I haven't, you know, I couldn't tell you what the Cincinnati Zoo looks like. I couldn't tell you how difficult it is for a kid to get into, you know, this enclosure. I do know because, you know, I've been the father of a four-year-old, and I've been the father of three now four-year-old grandchildren, that sometimes they get away from you. And it doesn't mean that you are negligent when they do. And so, yeah, it's possible that that she behaved in a way that could lead to some type of child endangerment crime. But to make that decision, I think, requires a very, very careful analysis of the circumstances, what she did, what the kid did. And I don't think that most of the people that are, you know, expressing their opinion about, you know, this woman's value as a mother and you know, whether she's a criminal or not have done that work.
Let's move on to some other issues. On orders from a judge last week, this was after last week's Week in Review, Governor Walker released emails showing that he wanted to simplify guiding principles for state universities last year, the University of Wisconsin system, as a part of a sweeping higher education proposal that would have dropped the long-standing Wisconsin idea from the UW's mission statement. Walker kept the records from the public for more than a year, but decided not to appeal Friday's decision, and he released 82 pages of emails. So apparently it wasn't exactly a drafting error that changed the Wisconsin idea during the budget process. How surprised are you at this, Eugene Kane?
Coming from this governor, not surprised at all. I think it's a transparency issue more than anything else. I mean, you can get into the details of the numerous instances people have found Walker suspect in terms of being able to give the public the information they need to know. I mean, if you have a politician who always seems to err on the side of keeping information from the public, I just don't see why most voters don't realize that's a bad thing. And, I mean, he needs to be called on it, and called on it steadily and frequently. And he always seems to live up to the lowest expectations of him in terms of that issue of transparency.
Mm-hmm. Rick Essenberg?
Well, you know, my organization publicly disagreed with the governor about his assertion of the deliberative process privilege, which we don't believe exists in Wisconsin law. We disagreed on some proposals to change the open records law. On the other hand, I think it would be inappropriate not to point out that this really is a bipartisan sin. I mean, people don't like, I don't like, wouldn't like either, you know, people sort of rooting around in their documents. You know, we had to litigate for a couple of years with Senator John Erpenbach, who didn't want to give us emails that we requested, or our client, the McIver Institute, requested. He cost the state a lot of money in resisting our request, took it all the way up to the Court of Appeals. So this is something that politicians do. In this case, I think the governor was poorly advised. I think the story from the outset was much ado about nothing. I don't think that withholding the documents was worth the candle. I understand that there are a lot of people in government who legitimately believe that there should be some kind of deliberative process privilege, that there should be some room for them to exchange ideas with themselves, you know, by email or by memo before that becomes public. My problem is I haven't seen anybody come up with a workable proposal for that wouldn't essentially gut the open records law, particularly when you have a legislature, when it's under both Democratic and Republican control, that has this tendency to want to drop bills and vote on them within a couple of days. So I don't think there can be a deliberative process privilege. I don't think it's outrageous for people to think that they might like to have one. I think the governor was poorly advised here. I think he was wrong. And you know, in this case, I think, and I don't say this very often, but I think in this case, the Dane County Circuit Judge got it just right.
Wisconsin Democrats will vote on a resolution at their state party convention this weekend that calls for the end of the superdelegate system, a move that is being pushed by supporters of U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders. Superdelegates are only involved in the Democratic presidential nomination process, unlike pledged delegates, which are awarded to candidates based on how they perform in the state's primaries and caucuses. Superdelegates can support whomever they choose. Superdelegates, according to supporters, raise the prospect that a candidate who wins the popular vote in the Democratic primaries could lose the nomination. So again, some Wisconsin Democrats want this changed, and they will vote on this resolution that would call for an end to the superdelegate system in Wisconsin. What's your reaction, Eugene Kane, to this? Do you think that this is does this vote have a chance? Do you think it's a good idea or not?
Well, from what I've learned about the superdelegate process, which I'm actually shocked that it took me this long to kind of get up to speed on it because I'm not a real political insider, there is a lot about it that ordinary voters should reject and don't like the idea. Even the name superdelegates, what makes them super after all? I mean, my attitude is that it's just a very strange way of having an election to give these chosen folks a particular power to influence an election. And the Bernie Sanders people who have made a case about, who have tried to make a case that things are rigged against them, this just gives them more fuel. And in Wisconsin, Bernie won Wisconsin, but the presence of the superdelegates will likely mean that Hillary will have, you know, greater sway over Wisconsin's votes because of that process. And on its face, that's just not right in terms of one vote, you know, one person, one vote. So I think it's time to look at the superdelegate process.
Mm-hmm. Rick Hessenberg?
Yeah, I sure wish the Republicans had some superdelegates. That would have been nice.
Mm-hmm. They've been handy this year, huh?
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that I think that people have to remember is that a political party is a private association, and the Supreme Court has recognized on a number of occasions that it has a constitutional right, a First Amendment right, to determine the way in which it selects its nominee. It doesn't have to have primaries. It doesn't have to do any of that stuff. Now, the parties have decided to do that. The superdelegates, I think, were a choice that the Democratic Party made to sort of hedge that process in response, I think, to the nomination of George McGovern, where, you know, the far left wing sort of captured the Democratic Party and it was a disaster in November of 1972. You certainly can make the sort of a populist criticism of that. It reduces the ability of sort of ordinary voters to influence the party nominee. But I think the party can come back and say, look, you know, this is part of the process for electing people to public office, but this is the process to elect our nominee, the nominee that is going to be put forth by a particular group of people, a particular private association called the Democratic Party. And you know, we have a right and we should be able to take steps to ensure that whoever is nominated is someone who is committed to, you know, the principles and the positions that this private association takes.
Oh, we have less than a minute left. I just wanted to get you both to weigh in very briefly on state races in the fall. The filing deadline was this week, and all of the various, there's going to be, of course, the U.S. Senate seat. There's going to be all eight of the congressional seats are going to be up for election, and a lot of state legislative ones, too. So, Rick Essen, are you watching one race in particular?
I think the Senate race is going to be interesting. I think it's going to be close. I think that because the Reid-Ribble seat is a vacant seat, and to the extent that we have a swing district in Wisconsin, that might be it. I think that's going to be close.
Yeah. And 30 seconds, Eugene, for the races that interest you the most?
It'll be interesting to see if his opponents can knock off Ron Johnson, because I think that'll make a statement about where Wisconsin is in the 2016 in terms of policies.
Well, we'll watch all of those. Thank you both very much for being with us. Eugene Kane, former columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Rick Essenberg, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. We will, by the way, be following up on the Democratic Party of Wisconsin's convention over the weekend in Green Bay. We'll be talking with our State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the issues that come up at the convention over the weekend. And we do at least have an invite to Martha Lanning, the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, to join us as well on our State Capitol report Monday between 7 and 8. This is the Ideas Network.